Good afternoon. Welcome to Subverting Silence. How can we change the dialogue on sexual violence? So to begin this event today, we'd like to acknowledge that this event is taking place on traditional, ancestral, unceded, and stolen territories of the Musqueam Nation. The colonial violence that has and continues to happen on these lands are deeply connected to sexual violence. When we talk about sexual assault and sexual violence, I ask that we be mindful of and critical about how sexual violence is connected to maintaining other forms of power and violence, and to think about whose voices and experiences are being centered in this space. So, like I said, Subverting Silence, How Can We Change the Dialogue on Sexual Violence is an event that culminates a year of organizing monthly dialogues on sexual violence as it impacts Asian Canadian communities. My name is Rachel, and I'm organizing this symposium with Tyler, Steph, and Amanda. So if you have any questions or concern, we'll all be around wearing these black t-shirts, so we're easily identifiable. We invite you to explore the questions today, such as what does subversion and silence mean through Asian Canadian contexts? How we can take collective action as students, staff, and faculty to change the conversation on sexual violence at UBC and beyond. So as we consider these questions around sexual violence, we'd like to share a content note. Please take care of yourselves and each other in ways that work best for you. So if that means leaving the room or like getting up to stretch whenever you need to, please feel free to do that. We will also have active listeners at this event that you can talk to. You can find a volunteer, so one of us, to point out where the active listener is today if you need to find one. So now I'm going to invite Nare up to talk quickly about active listeners for this event today.
Hi, I'm Nare. I'm from the Sexual Assault Support Center. I'm here on campus, or often known as the SASC. I just want to let you know that I'll be sitting at the back there with Anna. And if you are feeling triggered or if you just need someone to talk to for a little bit, then please come and find us and we're happy to chat with you.
Thank you, Nare. Moving on, we'd also like to invite you to think about space and awareness of power dynamics between folks in this room. We are centering Indigenous students and students of color's voices at this event, so please be mindful of your positionality and at what you are coming into this room with. So we ask that if you're staff, faculty, or community members, please respect who this event is for. Great. So the schedule for today's event will be located at the door, so there's one on this end of the room and also one on the outside. So if you need to reference it at any point today to see what's happening at what time, feel free to do so. And it's also posted up here right now on the slides. So in terms of accessibility, there are single stall gender neutral washrooms as well as gendered washrooms on each floor. Particularly on this floor, it's down the hallway to the right of the performance theater exit. And then for lunch, in terms of like food and snacks, there's going to be meat options, vegetarian options, and gluten-free options available for folks. So moving on, we would like you to please pull out your electronic devices or any devices that can access internet, and we ask that you join the UBC visitor Wi-Fi online so that you can participate with some online activities we have for the rest of today. So before we move on to the next bit of opening remarks, I'm going to invite Tyler to talk briefly about our online activities for today.
Yeah, so for today's Q&A panel, as well as our discussion with the director of the Apology, Tiffany, there'll be an opportunity to ask all our presenters some questions. So of course, we'll be taking in-person questions, but there's also an opportunity for you to submit questions anonymously online. So if you would like to do so, you can visit this website, slido.com. And if you enter the code 8617, you can enter our question room. So if you want to submit any questions anonymously, we will receive those and we can pass those forward to our panelists. Just keeping in mind sort of the nature of this event, so please be mindful and conscious of sort of what you're asking.
Thanks, Tyler. Isn't technology wonderful? Okay, so the ACAM Dialogue Symposium is generously sponsored by the UBC Equity Enhancement Fund, St. John's College, AMS Sexual Assault Support Center, CITR 101.9 FM, Discorder Magazine, and UBC Student Development and Services. So thank you so much to the sponsors for helping us make this event happen. Without you, we wouldn't be here, and I would be standing here speaking into this mic. So moving on to the next part of our opening statements. We're going to pull up our community agreements today, and these were formed based off of our previous dialogue events this entire year. So to briefly review these, the first one of the community agreements is feel free to take space, but make sure you're also leaving space for others, especially given what you're bringing into the room today. Remember confidentiality, take ideas out of here, but please don't take personal information with you. This is a space where there is no judgment. Please don't interrupt others. And lastly, be respectful in your dialogue, even when you don't agree. Great, thank you so much. So now I'm really excited to be moving on to the panelist section of our event today. So first, I'd like to acknowledge that in partnership with CITR 101.9 FM, who's located to my left, today's panel is also being broadcasted and recorded. So we're currently live on CITR 101.9 FM and online at citr.ca. CITR 101.9 FM broadcasts out of the AMS Student Nest Atrium, which is located in Vancouver on the unceded territory of the Musqueam people. The podcast for this panel will also be available on citr.ca if you wish to listen to it down the line. Okay, it is now my pleasure to introduce the panelists in the order that they will be speaking for today. So the first panelist that we have is Fred Chu. He is a PhD candidate in counseling psychology at the University of British Columbia. He is a registered clinical counselor and runs a private counseling practice in Vancouver. He has worked extensively with psychological trauma through clinical work with organizations such as Veterans Transition Network and Complex Trauma Resources. He also has a vested interest in collaborative and critical research approaches in social sciences and has conducted participatory research with youth in alternative education. His dissertation examines intergenerational trauma within Chinese-Canadian communities using a narrative methodology. So the next panelist that we have today is Leah Horlick. She is a writer who grew up as a settler on Treaty 6 Cree territory in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. Her first collection of poetry, Riot Lung, was shortlisted for a 2013 ReLit Award and a Saskatchewan Book Award. Her second collection, For Your Own Good, was named a 2016 Stonewall Honor Book by the American Library Association. Along with Esther McPhee, Leah co-curates Reverb, Vancouver's only queer and anti-oppressive reading series. She was recently awarded the 2016 Day Ogilvy Prize for LGBT Emerging Writers. Following Leah, we will have Kimberly Wong speak. She is a climate action and social justice activist majoring in geography, environment, and sustainability, and doing an interdisciplinary minor in gender, race, sexuality, and social justice, anthropology, and political science at UBC. She currently enjoys working as a community organizer with Love Intersections, a group of queer and trans people of color who form solidarity through a language of love and a lens of intersectional feminism, using a multimedia approach, and as a very proud founder of co-founder of City Hub Initiative. It's a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping youth succeed in their sustainability and social justice projects by providing basic infrastructure and guidance to them. Kimberly's most recent accolade includes winning the 2016 City of Vancouver Greenest City Leadership Award of Excellence. It's a very long award name. Okay, and last but certainly not least, we have Dr. JP Katungal. He is a queer, first-generation Filipino-Canadian settler living in unceded Coast Salish territories. He joined the Social Justice Institute, GRSJ, as an instructor after 2 years as a postdoctoral fellow with Concurrent Killam and SSHRC research fellowships. JP also holds faculty associate status in Asian Canadian and Asian Migration Studies and in geography. He acquired his PhD in geography from the University of Toronto in 2014. As a faculty member in the educational leadership stream, JP seeks to develop and enact queer of color and anti-racist feminist approaches to the scholarship on teaching and learning. He is particularly invested in analyzing and remaking classrooms and campus climates from the perspectives of queer and trans students, TAs and instructors of color, with a view towards examining the politics of emotion, positionalities, and embodiment in educational spaces, and their implications for pedagogy, curriculum, and mentorship. That was a lot, I know. So Each of our esteemed panelists will have 10 minutes to speak today, followed by a Q&A session with the audience. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Fred Chu.
So first of all, thank you for allowing me to be part of this, and it's a privilege to be able to speak, and also a privilege to be up here with all these wonderful colleagues who are doing really wonderful and powerful and meaningful work. I also want to thank the organizers who've been running around while I sat here and drank water. So thank you for all this wonderful work that you're doing. I believe that the fact that we are here, that we can talk very openly about sexual violence and violence within Asian Canadian communities, that that itself is a form of subversion. That my understanding is that there's been a few of these dialogues. And that is quite an incredible feat and opportunity that comes out of that. As a counselor, I often come from a perspective of really active listening and very intentional listening. And I see that through dialogue, it's really this kind of act of speaking and very intentionally listening to the stories and experiences that people have gone through. So I'm going to come from that perspective. I'm going to share a little bit about my views as a clinical counselor, and going to touch a little bit about this idea of silence from the perspective of intergenerational trauma. You know, in the counseling world, we have a lot of really quirky terminologies for very obvious things. When I think about this idea of subverting silence, in our counseling world, we use terminologies like immediacy, the here and now, transference, and countertransference. And essentially, it is all the same type of thing, is all touching upon this idea of kind of this meta conversation about really obvious things that are happening that nobody wants to talk about. Another way of understanding that is it's naming the elephants in the room. And my hope is, as we're kind of talking about this, that we can potentially name some potential elephants in the room, both from the lens of academia, and maybe also professionally as well. Mind you, as I was kind of going through all this, I might kind of jump from place to place. I realized that I won't be able to go really in depth in some of these, and I'm hoping that as we engage in dialogue and maybe some of these points that will be shared by others, that we can be able to fully kind of fill in some of these pictures here. But I'm going to talk a little bit about intergenerational trauma. Some of you may already be quite familiar with this concept. But intergenerational trauma refers to the transmission of psychological trauma from one generation to the next. And this could often come in the form of parenting, attachment, communication, kind of the psychosocial domains, and even some emerging research with regards to, even biologically, with regards to epigenetics. Intergenerational trauma has been applied to other cultural groups. There's literature on the Japanese-American internment camp survivors during World War II, and also with regards to survivors of the Khmer Rouge regime, the Cambodian genocide. But it hasn't really been applied to Chinese Canadians. And even in our Canadian context, and we could look at kind of the residential school survivors, that's some of the really great work that's being done right now, and also with regards to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but it hasn't really been done with regards to Chinese Canadians. And so there's a lot of silence in this area. There's only been one other dissertation with regards to looking at this topic. And so there's kind of a curious matter. Why has there been so much silence here? Is it because this is something that is unspeakable? Or maybe psychology has been a little bit slow in terms of adopting and looking at Chinese-Canadian or Chinese-American communities when it comes to psychological trauma? I don't necessarily have an answer to this, but I want to just pose that, because it just seems a little bit odd that in literature, even though it's been applied to many different cultural groups, it hasn't necessarily been looked at within Chinese-Canadian contexts or Chinese-American contexts. But when I think about this idea of intergenerational trauma, this is the idea that there has been a violation upon one's ancestors, one's parents, grandparents, or great-grandparents. And there's a deep silence there in that sometimes these traumas are not talked about. And it can manifest in other behaviors, either indirectly or directly. What ends up happening, though, and I'm not done my dissertation yet, so some of these ideas may be changed, but what I'm noticing as we're engaging in these studies and drawing stories from Chinese Canadian families is that there's a yearning to know what has happened amongst subsequent generations. There's also a disconnect. This could be a language disconnect, or maybe even a desire not to pass on what has happened. And what has happened in kind of as we're engaging through this is that it seems that the silence gets louder and louder and louder. No one wants to necessarily want to talk about it, or people do want to talk about it, but not necessarily sure how to broach the subject. And all of us could kind of, you know, if you draw upon your own life experiences, you could probably be able to draw upon some of that, whether a friend has gone through some very challenging circumstances, and you don't know necessarily how to approach that. How much do I name that, and how much do I continue to acknowledge that? At what point does it become awkward? This is one of those things where we're trying to name the elephant in the room. When I think about this topic, maybe one of the reasons why there hasn't been much work done on this is that in psychology, we've also had a bit of a history of applying psychological constructs inappropriately to different cultural groups. And maybe the concept of intergenerational trauma may not necessarily apply that well within Chinese Canadian communities. This is kind of one of those questions that we're continuing to work on. If you look at some of the indigenous scholars, some of them actually do push against this idea of intergenerational trauma, and some would prefer the terminology of historical trauma, or some would even push against this idea altogether. And so I do want to kind of touch upon this. When we are speaking about this idea of silence, I do want to touch on maybe there are aspects of silence that are maybe aligned culturally, that there are aspects of silence which we do need to speak against that are oppressive, and maybe there are aspects of silence that need to be honored as well. So I'm going to dial back just a little bit. When we look at the concept of intergenerational trauma, some of the original researchers coined the term of the conspiracy of silence. Researchers like Dr. Yale Danelli has coined this terminology, and it's been applied to other groups, victims of sexual assault and rape as well. And this idea that people who have gone through these atrocities, and Danelli was looking specifically at Holocaust survivors, that they were not taken seriously within their communities, within their peer groups, sometimes within their family, and worst of all, professionally, that professionals were not taking them seriously. And it wasn't until subsequent generations, second, third, fourth generations, began to try to uncover what has happened to their ancestors that we were able to find and learn more about what happened during the Holocaust. So there has been, to me, when we look at this idea of the conspiracy of silence, there are aspects of that that are inherently oppressive. So I do want to acknowledge that there are aspects of silence that are inherently oppressive. And what I mean about this idea of maybe there are aspects of silence that may itself, that there are aspects of silence that we should honor. You know, I want to touch upon, kind of jumping to my other identity as a counselor, that there's aspects of silence that I do want to honor as a counselor. With regards to the concept of intergenerational trauma, and sorry, I'm kind of jumping back and forth here, but with regards to the concept of intergenerational trauma, there are stories that I do want to know in terms of what happened to my ancestors, but I also want to acknowledge that maybe there are stories that they intentionally do not want me to know. And how do I honor that? I know that my grandfather has gone through very significant traumas, and I only learned about that after he passed away. But I do want to honor that maybe there are aspects that he did not want to pass on. And there are aspects of that that I do want to honor. And obviously, it's very hard to be able to figure out what that is exactly. Now, I realize that I'm probably, this is just a little bit longer. Okay. So professionally, what I mean by honoring silence as a professional, that sometimes as I'm working with somebody who has gone through very challenging life circumstances, traumas, or sexual abuse, that sometimes some of those atrocities are so searing that the only way that I could really honor what has happened to them is to be silent. That there's no words of condolence, that there's no words of reassurance that I could say to this other person except to just be silent. I think there's a role as counselors, even though we're trained to learn to listen well, there's a role for us to know when to be silent. I think counseling inherently is very valuable. It would really suck because I've studied this for a very long time, and if I think it doesn't work, then that'd be a bit problematic. I think the idea of witnessing the other, giving space to the other to be able to speak about their experiences and to listen well is inherently a very valuable thing that I think that goes beyond culture. And there's a lot of research that would support that. This is the idea of the therapeutic relationship. But I think one of the elephants in this profession is that we have a tendency to apply concepts in the literature that do not always work in some of the different cultural contexts. That sometimes we are not as informed about some of the unique cultural circumstances that our clients may go through. And I think and I'm not sure how many are aware of the counseling world, but we have a whole bunch of different emerging counseling strategies, and sometimes we call it the ABCs of counseling, because you could call it CBT, DBT, and all that type of stuff. But it can be sometimes problematic, because sometimes these theories are applied uncritically. And dare I say, when it's applied uncritically, it may perpetuate silence and oppression. So I'm going to try to wrap up because I think my 10 minutes is pretty much up. You know, as a counselor, I have a privilege of witnessing some very incredible stories. I have a privilege of witnessing people who have gone through some very horrendous atrocities and had the privilege of being able to hold that space for some of them. That has been a profound impact on me as a person. That my clients changed me as a person. That my clients who have experienced sexual violence changed me as a person to be more kinder, to be more aware. And it's this wonderful process as they are able to integrate these atrocities into their own narrative that I see that they themselves are able to do some very profound things in their communities. That through these horrendous events that they've experienced, they're able to use that to create change. And to me, that is a form of subversion. And so I think as a society, and kind of touching on this idea of the conspiracy of silence, of this needing to speak against, that as a society, as peers, as academics, and as professionals, we have a duty to foster these voices, to build up these voices, because these are expert voices. And these are very powerful voices, and these are very crucial voices that are needed when it comes to subverting silence, when it comes to violence in Asian Canadian communities.
Now I'm going to invite Leah to, as our next panelist, to present.
Thank you all so much. I was telling Kimberly earlier, I'm still a bit stunned to have been invited, and I feel very privileged to be in this space, so thank you. And thanks to Fred. I'm just going to take a moment because I'm quite affected by your presentation. That was really, really resonated with me in a lot of ways. Before I go any further, I'd like to thank Stephanie for spending a tremendous amount of time with me over email helping me prepare for this morning, and to the entire ACAM team for all of the very obvious thought and care that's been put into this entire event. I'm really looking forward to staying. As a non-Asian Jewish lesbian of mixed Romanian descent, it's really a privilege to be asked to take up space today, and I hope that I'll be able to do that invitation justice. I'm looking forward to speaking about the solidarities and strategies that we might share across our communities. Some of you might recognize me from my role at Simon Fraser University, where I'm the Simon Fraser Student Society Women's Center Coordinator. I'm here today in my personal capacity on an off day as a poet and a writer and a sexual assault survivor. I want to let you know that I'm going to be talking specifically about racism and sexual violence in my presentation, including some of my personal experiences with zero graphic detail. But please do whatever you need to do to take care of yourself, and I promise I won't be the slightest bit offended if you get up and move around, go get a drink of water. I honestly won't even notice I have stage brain right now. When I was preparing my notes for this morning, I spent some time reflecting on the similarities I notice in current anti-Semitism and anti-Asian rhetoric in Vancouver. While historically I notice Jews and folks constructed as Asians have been perceived as mutually exclusive, I think it's really important for Jews in particular to recognize that there are many, many Asian Jews, and for some of us, including myself, like, Romania is as far as you can go before Europe stops, right? We're also from Asia as a continent. So I just want to recognize that those categories are very constructed and that Jewish communities in particular are really bad for drawing those arbitrary lines. I think we also share many similarities in the ways that our communities live in diaspora and encounter racism through our experiences of migration, and that these similarities really influence how we talk about and also how we experience sexual violence. So I'm just going to name a few this morning. I want to recognize too that I'm new to the Lower Mainland, so many of the historical examples I learned while I was on the prairies. I have an upcoming meeting with Harsha Walia to talk about some stories that were translated to her in the 80s that I'm really looking forward to learning more about. I think the thing that really stands out for me is something that potentially unites Jews and Asians is the bind of the model minority. We walk a fine line between being seen as model citizens thanks to our values of community and education, and then between being cast as these conspiratorial parasites that are out to ruin Hollywood and or the Vancouver housing market. I think also, like many other groups, Jews and Asians have had to navigate a series of systemic barriers that prevented many of us from landing or migrating, as well as integrating, and we're now punished for those barriers that were put up to keep us out. I'm thinking specifically of the head tax for Chinese Canadians, and the parallel experiences of Jewish refugees in 1939 and Punjabi refugees in 1914 with the experiences of the Komagata Maru and the St. Louis, which were the ships that were just kept out in the ocean and couldn't dock until they either needed to return to a place where they would eventually be killed or colonially experiencing more violence. And I think there's also a shared experience of lynching and mob-related violence that affects our communities that we don't talk about very much, specifically the destruction of Japanese businesses in Vancouver and Jewish experiences of Kristallnacht in particular, as well as parallels between concentration camps and the internment of Japanese Americans. We also, I notice, are just still continually faced with these racial stereotypes that relate to our relationships with money and theft and greed. I know that's something that Jews really struggle with, and Asian folks are constantly having projected onto them in the current climate in Vancouver. And gendered stereotypes that include the desexualization of Asian and Jewish men and the idea of tiger mothers and neurotic Jewish mothers. For me, something that's important to talk about, especially right now in this moment on UBC campus, is an unwillingness of Jewish communities in particular to talk about our role in the colonization of other nations and how intergenerational trauma may affect our current complicitness in colonial violence. Speaking specifically, of course, about the treatment of Palestinians in Palestine, as well as Indigenous folks in Taiwan for Asian Canadians. We also, I think, particularly for the Jewish community, need to work on our internal struggles with rampant anti-blackness and anti-Islam rhetoric in our communities, and then just the cultural emphasis on survival and achievement that can create a really challenging climate in which to talk about intercommunity abuse and trauma. One example I'll offer from my own cultural history is the tendency for Jews to overemphasize histories of Jewish women being sexually victimized by Soviet and Nazi police and obscure the incidences of sexual assault that occurred between Jews in concentration camps. I notice our community really struggles with the possibility and the reality that sexual violence can happen between Jews as well, and that it's not just a colonial tool or a fascist tool of violence that was used against us, that it can happen between people of the same identity and the same religious background is really challenging for us. There's also a cultural reluctance of Jews to talk about the ways in which Holocaust trauma manifested in domestic abuse, child abuse, and intimate partner violence. And you know, it's interesting, like Fred, we were saying about how some of the earliest studies about intergenerational trauma focused on Holocaust survivors, but that just hasn't made it into our community yet as an idea or dialogue. A good example of a work that does address this is the graphic novel series Mouse. I don't know if any of you have read it, but that author does a really excellent job of breaking silence in some very interesting visual and textual ways about how Holocaust survivorship translated into violence in his family. So I highlight these issues not to draw analogies, because each of our cultural histories are nuanced and complex, and I'm conscious of how large ethnic or geographic catch-alls like Asian or Jewish serve to erase nuance and our realities, but I do want to draw attention to a few sites where Asian and Jewish solidarities might be built, and how these very broad themes influence how our communities interpret and experience exposure to sexual violence. It's also important to note how our own cultural histories of sexual violence influence our present understandings. I know we're here today to talk about strategies that we can use to change the dialogue specifically at UBC. And I would argue that the most important thing we can do to create a survivor-centered dialogue on sexual violence is to recognize that each of us are coming to university contexts with our own histories that may already include sexual trauma, and that our cultures influence how, when, and where we might be sexually victimized, as well as how we will respond and the kind of support that we need. Policies and practices that do not recognize this deep intersectionality will, I feel, only fall into the same trap that nonprofit anti-violence organizations have for years, which is the trap of offering services that only meet the needs of white, able-bodied, cisgender women who have experienced sexual violence perpetrated by men who were their intimate partners. One of the most shameful parts for me of recognizing my own partner assault was recognizing that I had been racially fetishized and exotified without even fully having an understanding of myself as a racialized woman. This is something that Jews are really trying to work out now. Are we people of color? Some of us are people of color. Some of us live with white privilege. Some of us enact racial violence on other people every day. How do we navigate that as a collective? And what does that mean? So it took me a minute to be like, oh, I am being perceived as a person of color. I'm not sure if I'm going to own that identity yet. I'm also experiencing anti-Semitism at the same time, but those things are different. And, oh, I think I've experienced sexual violence. What's going on? No mental health professional was prepared to help me with the idea that, coming from a family of second-generation migrant values, I've been given every opportunity, therefore nothing could be wrong. And it's only been later in life that I realized there may also be a connection between post-traumatic stress symptoms that I developed and the Holocaust-related trauma in my family. All of these factors, before even addressing the fact that I was sexually assaulted by a woman who was my partner, set me up to be a special case. But I think in reality, through working with many, many survivors, I've come to learn that there is no special case and there's no standard survivor. I strongly believe that in order to shift the dialogue, we need to open up anti-racist conversations about the way that our own communities respond to sexual violence before we can address systemic issues at institutions. I was just going to share a poem with you before I finish up, because that is my original genre. I'm stepping out of my comfort zone today speaking. So this, I think, is just a nice way to kind of synthesize the ideas I was talking about. It was sad when my book came out. I was continually told by Jewish outlets that there wasn't enough Jewish content in my book. I was like, well, I'm a Jew and I wrote it, so therefore it's Jewish. This is just a little bit about that experience. This poem is called The Yellow Scarf. The yellow scarf makes you look like a brown person, she says. Since when have you been brown? And in the dress you're straight, and the hat makes you look like an immigrant. Your breasts are coined with raisins. Your skin is the color of cinnamon. You are food. Your children will be Vikings. She's talking to her brother about the turkey baster already, but you are seven generations of women who hid under the kitchen table from horses and men. And how is this any different? you and your grandmothers will be gone before anyone notices, faster than you can say Jew. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Leah. And now I would like to invite Kimberly to the podium to present.
Thank you for having me. You'll have to excuse my voice. It's a little bit weak right now as I'm getting over a cold. Right behind us is a picture of my grandma and my grandpa on their wedding day. And behind them are my great-great-grandfathers, Phuong Wong and Tom Mar. And I used to look at these pictures with a certain kind of wonder, and still do, but now I feel a sense of guilt when I look back at these kinds of photos of my family, whose incredible decisions of gumption and bravery got me to where I am today, literally. I've been exploring the ways in which I feel connected to this land as what I call an immigrant settler, aka people see me as an immigrant instead of a Canadian, and I acknowledge that I am a settler on this land. I am a queer Chinese woman, and I acknowledge that I'm a settler on unceded First Nations land. My great-great-grandfathers came over from the Hoi San province to help build the Canadian Pacific Railway in 1875, and at the ages of 17 and 21, they came over in hopes of a more prosperous future, like many others. So a quote from my grandma, who can't be here because she's at dim sum with her Mahjong friends, the real unrecognized fathers of Confederation were these gentlemen, and they were the ones who really built Canada. Can you imagine Canada without the railway? So they were subject to very blatant forms of racial discrimination and abuse, but were incredibly proud individuals, so they never let their family know until they were able to be together here in Canada. And my grandma has wanted to tell me about this history since I was a little girl, but I could, she could sense that I wasn't ready with myself to hear it. So I've been exploring this history in search of where I'm from as a confused and insecure human whose Canadian identity is constantly in question. And what I mean by that is that I get asked the question, where are you really from? All the time, and I'm sure that many of you guys can empathize with that. I've learned to have a lot of fun with it. So I tell them I'm from Canada, and if they don't accept that, then I tell them that I'm from Vancouver, and if they ask where my parents are from, I tell them my mom is from Kamloops and that my dad is from East Van, and if they persist further, then I tell them that we moved from Richmond when I was a young child to Arbutus Ridge, but we considered living in Colchano or Kitsilano. So I've been thinking about this question that I have and how this question that I've begun to accept has contributed to the ways in which I see myself as belonging to this land, as a hyphenated identity, as a Chinese Canadian, not ever just accepted as Canadian. So I've been able to have fun with this question, but for others who may not be as much of a poop disturber as myself, or for those who may just take this question for face value and accept it as part of their routine, this has deep, settled effects on the ways in which I and many others see themselves as belonging in a country that is so white projecting and dominated. So in high school, I learned very fast that it was a detriment to my identity to be like those Asians or associated with them in any kind of way. It's really cringy. I was by no means the only person of color that existed in my school or in my grade, but I was one of the only Chinese people who had happened to have predominantly white friends. So these white friends to me at that time seemed normal because I'd always had predominantly white friends and because I felt the most comfortable with having mostly white friends. Still, I felt as if I had to prove my Canadian-ness at every turn to these friends. I took pride in knowing that they saw me as things like whitewashed and like a banana or not even really Asian, and didn't realize the implications of this until I started understanding how much my self-hate and insecurity was wrapped up in that all. And it didn't take long for me to realize that the same racism I had experienced in high school was also present in the climate action world, because these people were legitimized by their communities and by the media. It was always too Asian this or against China that. Like, for example, there's an influx of recent blaming and villainizing of China, which some of you touched upon, in many of the industries that Canada prides itself over, such as forestry or coal exportation, wherein China is seen as a polluting, rich, and invasion-like country of people. Many protests in the environmental community call for the stopping of blank fossil fuel being exported to China And there was even a campaign run by a modern, very reputable organization called Stand Up to China. I was kind of taken aback by that. So to give you some awesome context as to how I got into the science of activism, I started as a musical theater nerd with a group of friends who were also all musical theater nerds, who cared deeply about the ways in which our environment was changing but felt hopeless under the Stephen Harper conservative regime. So we created a group called Kids for Climate Action and performed flash mobs with altered lyrics, like climate change is coming to town during Christmas time in public spaces. We also had choreography that you could find somewhere on YouTube. We wanted to engage ourselves in the political process, but as we were all under 18, we couldn't vote, so we started performing flash mobs and garnered a lot of media attention as youth singing about climate change. And we developed into a group of about 10 committed youth who did things like bike from Vancouver to Victoria, we took the ferry, don't worry, to drop off petitions opposing the Enbridge pipeline at Parliament. And we fought the Port Bench of Vancouver in their coal port expansion proposal out of Fraser Surrey Docks, among many other projects. So I realized that my passion for climate action activism really only occurred when I felt accepted in a general sense, and when I had the ability to care about something other than the racism and sexism that I had felt so fiercely in other realms of high school. Going back to the question, where are you really from? I think that this question can be harmless if coming from a place of good intentions, but more often than not, can have strong rooted effects on how people see themselves contributing or belonging or incorporating the Canadian identity within themselves. And if people don't see themselves as belonging to this country, how are they going to protect its coast or its land or whatever? How can they do this if their belonging is always being questioned? And so I think that, speaking from my own experiences, that we must move forward to make the climate action movement more inclusive and make it more accessible. And with this realization, I've begun to host workshops at my nonprofit's co-working space, City Hub Initiative, called Climate Feels. It's really millennial. We tell stories about our experiences in Canada as a conglomerate of young POCs and as young immigrants, and we try to give each other space to develop our storytelling skills in order to better serve a place in the climate action world as activists, as scientists, as human beings with the will to understand and be compassionate and see things through a lens of love and humor. I talk about my queerness and coming out a lot in these workshops to serve as a reminder that you can absolutely belong to many different kinds of communities. For example, you can belong to the climate action community and be Chinese and be queer. But when I talk about my high school qualms and about how my being Chinese was enough, I mean that it was enough to deal with in high school, and that I didn't have time to explore my queerness because I was too busy trying to be white. And if we want to draw a comparison to my grandmother's train of thought, whose entire being I look up to and cherish and treasure, she doesn't quite understand why I choose to be vegetarian. Because when she was a young person, her family could only afford to eat meat twice per year during Chinese New Year and the August Moon Festival. And I think the way she expresses it to me is, why do you choose to eat like a peasant? She can't understand why I'm over here wanting to cut down my carbon emissions because she's over there happily eating her cha siu bao with pride. She can't understand why I'm queer if she's happy just living in Canada. As the millennials say, why you gotta be so extra? So I just can't believe how long I've neglected my culture, because within this past term of studies at UBC, I've learned about my family's history and about all the yummy, heart and stomach warming cultural qualities of being Chinese, and it's been so incredibly beautiful and filled with love that it made me go to China. I'm embarking on my first trip to Asia this coming May to trace back my family's history, to visit my ancestral village, to learn more about my Chinese culture as an act of self-love in reclaiming my own culture. And the pride of my Chinese ancestors and my own pride as an extension of learning about my own family history has led me to understand the bounds by which culture is defined. Culture is the food that we eat, the pathways that we walk around in, the people that we meet, the conversations we have, the time we spend with loved ones, and the entirety of an ecology of peoples, and I can't wait to explore it more this summer for myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Kimberly. So last but not least, I'd like to invite JP as our final panelist for today.
I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me to be part of this conversation. It is an honor to be following the speakers that have gone before me. It is also an honor to be part of this very important, sometimes very difficult conversation with you folks. So thank you for being here on a Saturday. I'd like to begin, as we have already done, with a territory acknowledgement, an acknowledgement that we are doing this work on the traditional ancestral unceded territories of the Halkominum-speaking Musqueam people in the broader Coast Salish territories, including the land of the Tsleil-Waututh and the Squamish. Why is this important? As Rachel noted in the beginning, this is not just a box to be ticked, but a reminder of the very conditions of displacement and violence on which we do the work that we are doing today. Settler colonialism, as has already been noted, relies and has relied heavily on the imposition of Euro-Christian gender and sexual norms, binaries, for example, including proper definitions of family and the subjugation of women and two-spirit people. That was part, and that is part, of the racial project of civilization that is settler colonialism. About a 5 to 10 minute walk away from here is the Reconciliation Pole. It was erected in community last weekend under the leadership of Haida, Musqueam, and other indigenous peoples. It is a reminder of the violence of residential schools, including the gender and sexual violence that was visited upon students in these residential schools. So this is, again, very much part of this conversation. Settler colonialism also continues today in part through the gender-based violence that is visited upon Indigenous women. Hopefully folks know in this room about the cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women, and that is part certainly of the context and the continued practice of settler colonialism today. As I was preparing for today's panel, I thought quite a lot about what it means to subvert silence, which is really the kind of the question that frames the task before us today. And I went theory, because I've been teaching 3 heavily theoretical courses this term, and I'm reminded of the work of Gayatri Spivak, the amazing subaltern theorist, who argued that we need to pay attention not so much, or at least not just to silence itself, but more importantly to the conditions that produce silence. Right? She asked the question, can the subaltern speak? And the way that she answered that is actually by reframing the question itself. Why is the subaltern not being heard? Right? What are the institutional and cultural conditions of silencing that we need to pay attention to when we are considering this very question of subverting silence? So to me, following this amazing theorist, to subvert silence is therefore not just to speak, but to strike at the conditions that silence. Okay? So a quick caution from that. Subverting silence is not to coerce speech, to force people to speak. As Fred noted, there are reasons why people might want to not speak. Right, and that is important to honor as well. Right, to subvert silence is therefore, to me, to create conditions in which speech is possible, that it is an option for folks who might want to speak. Right, it is to ensure that the barriers to speech are contested and reworked. In the context of the university, what does that look like? It looks a little bit like what we are doing in this room. Right, it looks like the leadership of students. With support from those of us who are able to support, those of us in positions of access or proximity to resources or to title or to power, right? It looks like institutional support without co-optation. Right? It looks like curricular change, slow and painful process. It looks like, for those of us who are particularly in positions of power, stepping back, right? And it, like I said, it looks a little bit like this, right? One other thing that I wanted to mention in terms of silence is to link silence to the reproduction of normativity, which is to say that one important condition for silence concerns its utility for reproducing notions of what is respectable. Right? So we can talk, for example, about shame and the cultural, particularly culturally situated notion of shame. Part of that comes from the desire to protect the image of the family, the culture, or the community. And shame, as many scholars of gender and sexual violence has noted, is crucial for maintaining silence, particularly around gender and sexual violence in particular cultural contexts. Yeah. The use of shame, the utility of shame, must be interrogated in part because it is really proximal. It stands beside ideas around what it means for a family or a culture or a community to be seen as respectable, right? So how do we define respectable, therefore, as part of the question that we should be interrogating today, right? What it means to be respectable often means adhering to norms around gender and sexuality. Right? It means maintaining some semblance of a nuclear family without problems. And we know that one effect of this is very much gendered, that it often falls on women to maintain family and its respectability as respectable, right? It means that sacrifice for the good of the family is therefore gendered work, right? Sacrifice in the name of respectability becomes a gendered duty for the greater good of a normative notion of family, right? What it means to be respectable is also has historically been shaped by histories of colonialism back home. Right? The imposition of bourgeois sexuality, the idea of a respectable nuclear family and compulsory heterosexuality, was part of the colonizing work of the Dutch in Indonesia, Ann Stoller has documented this, of the Spanish and the Americans in the Philippines, the British in Malaysia, Singapore, Hong Kong, India, Pakistan, etc. You know where I'm going with this, right? That we need to think also historically about our own investments in what we think are traditional notions of family that might not actually be that traditional, right? That might be in part an effect of histories of colonial violence. In the diasporic context in which many of us are located, certainly here, part of the politics of respectability is also a certain desire to be in proximity to the nation state, to cultural nationalism, and to normative ideas about migrant citizenship. Right? Shame often emerges out of a desire for two things. First is a shame that is meant to maintain an authentic cultural identity, right? The desire to remain traditional, right? The queer of color South Asian scholar Gayatri Gopinath has noted that in a bid to maintain authentic cultural identity, in the face of a new home, right, ethno-racial communities often adhere ever more and in an even more hardened way to tradition, right, including traditions of gender and sexuality. Thus, Gopinath argues that cultural nationalism in the diaspora is reproductive of normative, traditional ideas around gender and sexuality. Right? So that is, again, part of the work that shame does. It's a desire for a cultural authenticity in some ways. A second thing that shame does in terms of desire is a desire to succeed in the Canadian context through ensuring that one does not rock the boat. Right? So silencing someone because they might contest the notion that one is proximal to normative migrant citizenship in the Canadian context. It can mean that one does not point out problems around gender and sexuality here, right? So it maintains a notion of Canadian nationalism that invite immigrants to adhere to the idea of Canada as modern, tolerant, and above all, queer-friendly and feminist. right? This is the idea of Canada that is maintained by locating violence as coming from somewhere else, that it is not inherently part of the making of Canada as a nation itself, which given what we've already said about settler colonialism, is just not the case. A final question that I want to pose for us as we continue doing this work today and further is, what does justice look like? What do we mean by justice? Does justice look like a commitment to the prison industrial complex? Does it mean a commitment to a policing model that Indigenous and Black communities time and again have experienced as racial violence? Right? Where the promise to serve and protect is not evenly doled out and is sometimes even denied to certain communities. I want to bring up the case of Daniel Holtzclaw. Daniel Holtzclaw is a half Japanese, half white Oklahoma City police officer who targeted Black women, many of whom have histories of criminalization for sexual violence. Right? Daniel Holtzclaw went specifically to Black neighborhoods to target Black women, right, in his duty as a cop. Right? He abused his privileges as a police officer by being able to and looking up Black women's criminal histories. And he used the threat of his status as a law enforcement agent to coerce Black women into sexual assault and rape. Is Daniel Holtzclaw's sexual violence against Black women part of the conversation about how we should be subverting violence? Part of why I mentioned Daniel Holtzclaw today is to note that this conversation about sexual violence should also be about how we as Asian diaspora communities relate to other racialized communities. And to think about our own complicities in the continuation of gender, racial, and sexual violence. How do we ensure that this is not just an internal dialogue, but also a dialogue across communities? And Leah's presentation has pushed us to do that today. It's also a dialogue about how we might participate in the gender and sexual violence of law itself, right? So following Leah's presentation, I wanna pose the question, is the model minority one who takes for granted the goodness of the law? And if so, why? What is our investment in a law that has produced violence, right? So coming from that is the question, how else might we imagine and organize justice, right? From the perspective of community without reproducing the violence of law itself, right? So finally, I promise, I want to recognize and affirm the leadership of students and staff, both at ACAM and elsewhere, including many of my students. It is constantly an honor to work with you all. You folks make this university not only bearable, but also even productive and very much fun. I see you and your work, the important interventions that you are doing in this community, and we are a community, we are UBC, whether we recognize it or not, or whether they recognize it or not. Right? Thank you for being here and for changing this university one dialogue and one class at a time. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Fred, Leah, Kimberly, and JP for your presentations. Please join me in giving a round of applause to our panelists. So I'd now like to open the floor to questions from the audience at this time. And please be mindful, I put the slide up again, but you're welcome to submit questions to our online poll in Slido if you don't feel comfortable speaking in real life. No, that's not what I mean, but on the mic. I can start with a question if that would help folks kind of move along. Actually, this is for Fred specifically, but I was wondering if there were, you touched on this already, but I was really interested in this idea of like honoring silence, and I was wondering if there was a particular thing that happened or like something that you stumbled upon that made you start to think about the concept of honoring silence.
Thank you for the question. And I think it was actually very helpful for that last part about that the idea of contesting against some of the barriers to speech, because I think that's the other piece of it. When I think about this idea of honoring silence, I really do think about my experiences working as a counselor. That sometimes there's some very, I think that sometimes even in the counseling world and sometimes in the public spaces that we may be a little bit too voyeuristic towards some of the details as to what has happened with regard to some traumas. And I think about my work as a counselor that sometimes it is just simply being able to just acknowledge that has happened, that that itself can be very healing. I think about some of the work that I've had the privilege of doing with veterans, and some of the details are not necessary. Some of the details can be re-triggering and can be overwhelming and therefore untherapeutic. It's enough for me to just name that this particular atrocity has happened and to be able to just hold space in silence, because there is no way that I can fully understand what that experience has been like. And so I think, to me, that's I really kind of come from that particular angle, that there's aspects to for us to be able to honor and give space and give the opportunity. If they do want to speak, then by all means, they have the right to, and to contest some of the barriers that prevent people from speaking. But I think sometimes the most respectful thing to be done is to honor silence when I think that's kind of a can be a therapeutic strategy.
Oh, hello? Okay. I also want to speak to the question of honoring silence using a couple of examples. The first is Indigenous protocol and the ways that under Indigenous protocol, not all cultural knowledge is available to everyone. You need to be in community. You need to earn the privilege of knowing stories, knowing oral traditions, knowing myths. Some of that is ancestral, right? Many of that is ancestral. So that is a different configuration, too, of knowledge. Knowledge has cultural contexts, right? And I think that is when you were speaking earlier, Fred, that was one of the things I thought about, is the desire to know can be very colonial, right? It can be very imposing. It can be very violent, right? And that is in some ways the history of social science itself, is the kind of stealing of cultural knowledge, right? So that's one thing. The second thing is a more personal experience with me. I think it was last year or a couple of years ago, I was sitting at a coffee shop, and a couple of folks who were seated beside me decided to engage me in conversation. I was reading a book about race, and they were curious. And then next thing we know, there was very racist conversation about the threat that refugees bring to Canada, right? And it became very violent very quickly. In the way that our bodies are arranged in relation to each other, the two folks were towering over me, yelling, occupying a lot of sonic and physical space. And people intervened, right, using words. But one of the things that I remember very, very, very nicely about that experience is the shared look from another person of color who did not say anything. But in that silence of the meeting of the eye, there was a powerful kind of moment in which I know, right? That is a silence that speaks volumes, right? And so when we think about silence, what is it that we value? when we want to subvert silence? Like what? So I suppose part of what I'm trying to get at is how might we put silence to use? Right? Are we coming here with the assumption that silence always and already is something that we don't want or need? And so Fred's question earlier about how we might honor silence brought back these kind of things for me. So I wanted to share them as well.
Just going to add quickly too, the woman who first introduced me to the idea that you're touching on as well too is in the UBC community. I don't know if folks know Dr. Lucia Lorenzi, but her work, her dissertation in English focuses on a similar theme in literature and the idea that silence in particular related to narratives of sexual assault is fundamentally negative or oppressive. So she might be a person to get in touch with in your own community if she's around about it. Yeah.
Thank you so much for those responses. I would just like to put it out to the floor again. If any folks have any questions they'd like to ask, now is a very good time to do so. You're also welcome to, again, enter your questions into Slido if you're not feeling like you want to speak into the mic. This is like a really wonderful opportunity to talk to our panelists. Great.
So we received one question from the audience, and it is, to the speakers, in your experience, what were good speaking or response strategies when you suddenly find yourself in a racist or misogynist conversation?
So I have the privilege of being able to work with a group called Love Intersections, and Love Intersections philosophy speaks to specifically calling people in instead of calling them out. I think a lot of the conversations that we have surrounding difficult and divisive experiences is often focused on calling people out for what they are, not what they do, specifically with regards to like racially sensitive experiences. And every experience is different, but I like to engage in these through a lens of love and compassion and try to understand where they're coming from, because when I was trying to experience this world from my rather naive place, I probably seemed quite ignorant.
Yeah, I think it's really tremendous work that Love Intersections is doing around the calling in practice, and it's important, at least, I mean, especially for me with somebody with occasional white privileges, to talk about how that idea originated primarily in very, very marginalized communities of Black folks and folks living with multiple disabilities who cannot afford to lose or isolate people. And so something I try to remind folks, in particular, you know, this comes up a lot in the Reverb community, where we're working in a really nasty, colonial, can-lit environment where editors and publishers will also say really terrible things to you, like, oh, you know, we've already got a Muslim author this season, so we couldn't possibly publish another book. You know, we've already, you know, your book isn't Jewish enough, those kinds of things. For me, it's useful to remember that I can balance. Like, there's a time to call in and there's a time to not say anything, because it will put you in so much danger. Like, it will physically put you at risk to intervene or to say something, and you need to get out of there. And then also that there's a time to name a behavior and say, that idea is really misogynist. Or, you know, whenever I hear people say something like that, I think about how racist it is. And to, you know, there are some nonviolent communication strategies you can use, but also sometimes you just need to leave. And a lot of this has to do with how much sleep you've had the night before and what you had for breakfast. And if people are looming over top of you and you're in a public place, like, those things need to be considered as well for us to actually survive as, like, people of color and queer people of color in particular.
You know, as a counselor, my default is to listen, which is not always, which I've learned is not always the right thing to do. You know, I think there are opportunities to educate and opportunities to be able to listen and invite and to explore, you know, where are some of these perspectives coming from. And some of the factors and some things that you might want to take into consideration, whether or not you can actually are ready to engage in those type of conversations. But I think there are times when you have to, I think it is our role to be able to speak up and stand up when it is purely just malicious. I think, and I think this is kind of where we need to try to differentiate at what what aspects of it is a malicious act, and what aspects of it is it purely out of ignorance. And if it is in a place of ignorance, is there an opportunity to educate? Is there an opportunity to actually have a fruitful dialogue? And if it is actually something that is malicious, then I think we have a place to be able to speak up and stand up against that.
Thank you so much for those responses. We have time for one more question. So if folks are feeling courageous or brave, feel free to come and yes.
Hello. This is more of a question for Fred, and I'm trying to figure out a nice way to phrase it, but if coming from the mental health community, do you think that there is enough representation with people of color or people from queer and trans communities? Because in the counseling relationship, you do hold a position of power, and it is difficult to be vulnerable, and some information, as was previously discussed, it's not always, it can seem invasive to share certain, for a counselor to expect or to probe into certain stories and traumas and experiences. Do you think there's enough representation in mental health communities that communicate to people who want support and help, who can communicate that they're not losing this like part of them? Does that make sense?
Yeah. And thank you. That was very, very polite of you. did not come off as offensive. I do want to acknowledge that in the way that our society has been set up and the idea of healing, unfortunately, has kind of defaulted to this idea that counselors or psychologists or psychiatrists are the only forms or professions that can facilitate healing. And I think that's a very problematic assumption. There are things that I'm trained in, and there's things that I am aware of and skills that I do have that can facilitate healing. But I do believe that there are other forms of healing and cultural forms of healing that we do need to acknowledge and affirm. It gets problematic when we assume that counseling is the only form of healing, and I don't think that is. I do believe counseling works. I've studied this for a very long time, but I do think we do need to acknowledge those other forms of healing. With regards to kind of representation, I do feel like I am a bit of a minority. If I look at the different spaces that I am part of, this is really neat to be part of this space, but the spaces I'm part of are usually, the Canadian Psychological Association or the American Psychological Association. And I do feel like a bit of a minority in those spaces. And there is a need, I believe, for different cultural perspectives to be fostered in those spaces. Because there are some unique cultural and contextual understandings that I bring, and some of my colleagues who would be considered minorities do bring, and it's sometimes very difficult to speak up when you're kind of that lone individual representing a vast array of voices. And so I do agree. I think, when I say culturally appropriate, that's kind of a very simplification. But I do believe that there needs to be much more understanding of cultural diversity, and it should also be represented also within our professional communities as well. So I kind of hold these two different things that, I do believe counseling is beneficial. I study this. I don't want to waste my PhD. but I also believe that we do need to foster and acknowledge other forms of healing, both culturally, within our cultural communities, and even within this professional context, that this itself needs to also acknowledge this, the diverse voices, and also try to foster some of those voices as well. Thank you for that question.
I also want to add something to that, in part coming from another hat that I used to wear, which was when I was a PhD student. My research was on the emergence and evolution of AIDS social services that were ethno-specific, right? So what did that look like, and why is ethno-specificity important? Right, I think that is partly the crux of your question, right, in terms of representation. The history of the three organizations that I studied, Toronto-based AIDS organizations that serve Asian, South Asian, and Black communities, were histories of reaction to one might call like a race doesn't matter, liberal, multiculturalist approach to AIDS that emerged out of a queer community response that centered just sexuality without thinking intersectionally about the sexual politics of HIV/AIDS. These ethno-specific organizations emerged to contest the assumption of a one-size-fits-all approach, right? And I think that is partly, where your question is coming from, and also where Fred is going in terms of the response. In my research, I ask questions of service providers and folks who access these services, what it is about ethno-specific organizations that they appreciated. Almost inevitably, the answer went something like, there are people there who look like me. Right. And I think that was a shorthand for, I don't need to spend three sessions to explain to them what it means to be racialized, what it means to have an immigrant experience, right? So that people who look like me, it was a shorthand for shared knowledge and experience. I think that is partly it. Secondly, these ethno-specific AIDS organizations emerged from the community, and so they were not professional in the strict sense of the APA or the CPA. Right, they were peer-based, right, and which is another way of organizing support. And there, you know, the desire for something other than formal, kind of professionalized support systems already exists, right, in the forms of us beginning with active listening and the presence of active listeners in this room, right. Not trained psychologists, but folks who come at healing and support from a place of interpersonal everyday practice, which is really important. Another hat that I used to wear as a graduate student was I worked for an organization called the LGBT Youth Line, which served kind of a province-wide Ontario youth. And that was under the model of peer support as well. None of us were trained counselors, right? But peer support is another way of organizing support. And they do exist already. And so I suppose part of me kind of inserting these two experiences or analysis is to speak to Fred's comment about the need for more things, and more already exists in some ways.
I want to add one, and this might complicate the picture a little bit. Having the privilege of working with the Veterans Transition Network, and this is an agency that works specifically helping veterans transition from kind of wartime experiences to normal living, there is often, you know, I don't know how many of you know people who are veterans, there's often a very kind of distinct culture that they come from. And when we're running these programs, sometimes it kind of creates a us versus them type of mentality. You know, you're a civvy, you don't know what our experiences are like. And half the time it is trying to bridge that gap. And I do think that there, even, you know, I think it would be easier if I was a veteran myself, and then that would probably facilitate the process a lot easier. But there's also something quite profound that I, as a civilian, can also be able to hold and understand that suffering that my fellow Canadian or the veteran has gone through. There's something so profound about that witnessing, even though we can create this us versus them type of thing. And maybe there's something quite transcendent when I'm able to bridge that gap. And I'd argue that if you are seeking counseling services, if your counselor doesn't get you in 2 or 3 sessions, you have every right to fire them. And that's often what I tell my clients as well, that I'm here to work myself out of a job, and if I can't connect with you after 2 or 3 sessions, then you should fire me. And I think even if I don't have the same experiences or same cultural background or same completely the same life experiences, I think there's something about human nature that when we are able to understand the other, it can perhaps even sometimes transcend some of these boundaries that we call culture. So.
Okay, please join me in thanking our speakers once again. This event wouldn't have been possible without your presence and your openness to share your thoughts, and we're all so, so grateful for you speaking today.